Hey, thanks for listening to the History of the United States podcast. If you like what you hear, please rate me on Apple Podcasts. Honestly, it helps. Also, if you really like what you hear, support me on Patreon. A link to the fundraising site is on the podcast website, historyoftheunitedstatespodcast.wordpress.com. The direct link is patreon.com/US History Podcast, all one word. Also, a cool thing. The money pledged to me goes to the folks I support first. I think that is awesome, so if you support me, you're kind of supporting other creators. Now, on to history. An intelligent officer with 10 or 12 chosen men, fit for the enterprise and willing to undertake it, taken from our posts where they may be spared without inconvenience, might explore the whole line, even to the Western Ocean. Thomas Jefferson, 1803. Welcome in, welcome back to the History of the United States podcast, episode 75. What a great way to end a year with a milestone number. 75 podcasts. Thanks for listening. I did a quick word count on the scripts I have, which only started on podcast 24, and I've produced something like 50,000 words. I'm approaching a small book at this point, but I haven't even hit the, quote, midpoint, unquote, of U.S. history, but miles to go before I sleep. So, where were we? The Louisiana Purchase. Right. In the last cast, we discussed the ins and outs of the purchase itself, how it basically came to be, in relatively short fashion, no less. Napoleon needed to get A, some cash, and B, offload lands that had become a bit burdensome. Jefferson and his allies, bending their interpretation of the Constitution in order to get the deal of the century. Heck, maybe the best deal ever. After some minimal protests and debate in Congress, the deal was done. So, what did the U.S. get? A huge swath of land, pretty much a third of the continent, if not a bit more. It extended from the western bank of the Mississippi River as far west as the eastern side of the Rocky Mountains. It went as far south as the Gulf of Mexico, including the vital port city of New Orleans, and northward to the 38th parallel, or the border between the United States and Canada. The land purchased included all, or parts, of 15 modern states. For the most part, no one really knew a lot about the area. There was some knowledge gleaned from hunters and tradesmen, as well as what the Spanish offered about the land. But in truth, even the Spanish hadn't explored very much of it. No, in order to get a better idea of what was there, Thomas Jefferson commissioned a number of expeditions, the most famous being the Lewis and Clark Expedition. But before I get to that, I just wanted to mention a few of the other parties that went out. First was the Hunter and Dunbar Expedition, which was centered in the Southwest, in modern-day Arkansas and Louisiana. In all, not a very far-reaching exploration. But it did yield some interesting information, specifically about the hot springs in the area. Due to potential hazards with the Native American Osage people, Dunbar and Hunter were directed to investigate the springs as opposed to drive further west. So, Dunbar, his son, Hunter, two of his slaves, and a servant, along with 13 soldiers, went northward and slightly west to investigate the waterway to the hot springs. The voyage round trip only lasted a few months, from October 1804 until January 1805. But the two scientist explorers did record quite a bit. Their materials were the first to arrive to Jefferson about the Louisiana Purchase, and were of great interest to the always curious Jefferson. Of course, nothing they reported was news to the Native Americans of the area, really to a lot of the Europeans who traveled and traded throughout the region. The expedition was almost shorter than what was achieved. Only about a month into the journey up the Ouachita River, George Hunter almost blew his head off. No, really. In a scene far too familiar in the United States, while cleaning his gun, it fired. blasting its way through Hunter's thumb and seriously injuring two of his fingers. The bullet also went through his hat, barely missing his head. Hunter was able to soldier on, but was less than 100% for quite a while. Let this be a lesson to all you gun owners out there. When cleaning your guns, make sure they are not loaded. Then, make sure again. After spending about a month at the Springs, not a bad vacation that, the company journeyed home, which took only half the time, going downstream, don't you know? There was some talk of the duo heading out further west down the Red River, but it doesn't appear to have been much more than a thought, at least for Dunbar and Hunter. Both men were in their 50s, and I suspect that a four-month trip was already stretching their limits. I'm in my 50s, and being on the road for a week with all the modern conveniences of 2024 still tuckers me out. However, the Red River would be explored. The next expedition to give a brief look at is that of Freeman Custis. It can be a brief look because the expedition was, well, brief. Thomas Freeman, a surveyor by trade, and Peter Custis, a naturalist and a medical student, were the more scientific leaders of the campaign, while Richard Sparks, a captain in the United States Army, was chosen as the military leader, with some 40 or so soldiers under his command for the trip. The military presence was needed not only for the chance encounter with Native Americans, but with the possible contact with Spanish troops. Turns out, contact with the Spanish was anything but a chance encounter. A certain General John Wilkinson, in command of the Louisiana Territory, alerted the Spanish that a U.S. contingent would be in their territory. It further turns out, only to be proven years later, that Wilkinson was a spy for the Empire of Spain. But more on that in a later podcast. So, after only managing to go upstream on the Red River for about 600 miles, the notified Spanish made their presence known and confronted the party. While there was some huffing and puffing by Sparks, he soon realized that he was, A, greatly outnumbered, and B, under strict orders not to engage in any conflict with the Spanish. Jefferson didn't want to spark an international incident, which may have caused the French to wade into the fray, as they were allied with Spain at the time. Admittedly, that is a bit of conjecture on my part, seeing how Napoleon was engaged in a great continental war. But in Jefferson's eyes, I'm sure there was a feeling of, why risk it? The expedition did survey the northern portion of Louisiana and got a little further west than the Dunbar expedition, but that was about it. The goal of finding the headwaters of the Red River would have to wait. Which brings us to the core of discovery, or the Lewis and Clark expedition. For the longest time, and really to this day, Lewis and Clark are portrayed as heroes, blazing a trail across the continent and eventually arriving at the Pacific Ocean. To be sure, it was one hell of a journey, full of quote-unquote discoveries of flora and fauna throughout the upper plains and mountains of North America. I put discoveries in quotes because the people who lived there and those that traveled throughout the region in the past almost two centuries were well aware of what Lewis and Clark were finding. However, the indigenous peoples didn't catalog their surroundings in a Western European fashion, and the Europeans who did encounter the area weren't really interested in doing that chore either. That, of course, was one of the overriding interests of Thomas Jefferson and his appointed collector, Meriwether Lewis. A scion of a prominent Virginia family, Meriwether Lewis grew up as a neighbor of Jefferson. When the Whiskey Rebellion broke out in 1794, Lewis volunteered to curb the uprising. Go back a few podcasts for details, but you may remember, it wasn't much of an uprising or battle. More of a threat, and the rebels pretty quickly backed down. With the defeat of the Native American forces at Fallen Timbers, that's also in a past podcast, the U.S. Army underwent a reduction of force. Even so, Meriwether Lewis was not part of those cuts. Instead, he was given an officer's commission, keeping him on the frontier where he was enjoying himself perhaps a little too much. Lewis was brought up on charges, including intoxication and challenging a fellow officer to a duel. Though found not guilty, it was apparent Lewis couldn't stay in the same outfit as his accuser, So he was shipped off to another company, commanded by another Virginian, William Clark. Though this initial pairing would only last for 6 months, due to Clark needing to return home, it is here that their friendship began. Lewis, for his part, remained in the army and did rise in the ranks, becoming a captain in 1800. In 1801, Lewis was called by neighbor Jefferson, now President Jefferson. The new president wanted a secretary who wasn't just useful for day-to-day tasks, but who also had knowledge of the military and the Western country. Lewis was a perfect candidate. He had a number of tasks in dealing with the army, specifically helping Jefferson decide which officers to let go, as the new Republican tide saw fit to reduce the army, as covered it also in an earlier podcast. Most interestingly, Lewis lived in the White House, not called that yet, but he did live with Jefferson in that house. As Jefferson commented to his daughter, "Captain Lewis and myself are like two mice in a church." Not only did Lewis work for the president, but he ate with him and attended the social dinners that Jefferson frequently hosted. Not a bad gig, except maybe for the housing, which was cold and drafty. Lewis's room was where the previous tenant, Abigail Adams, hung her laundry. Even so, through his association with Jefferson, Meriwether Lewis was quite the made man in American politics. Fast forward to 1802 and the sale of Louisiana to the United States. No need to rehash all of that, but after the purchase, Jefferson was obsessed with going west. He had been fascinated with the western frontier since he was a child, and this was a bit of a realization of that dream. It was his young secretary who got to do the exploring. To the shock of no one, Meriwether Lewis was commissioned to lead the exploratory company and to venture into the northern part of the Louisiana Territory, if at all possible, to get to the Pacific across the Northwest. Though Jefferson had every confidence in the young man, Lewis still needed some training. He was an accomplished woodsman and traveler, but Jefferson wanted him to be a scientist on the expedition. To that end, Jefferson planned for Lewis to gain a crash course in the natural sciences, complements of the leading scientific minds in the United States, largely centered in Philadelphia. Lewis also began studying all that he could about the Missouri River, reading maps and absorbing as much as he could. But there was more than studying to be done. Lewis set off around the country to gather supplies and hopefully volunteers for his expedition. He eventually made it to Philadelphia to begin his crash course in the sciences. The studies, along with more supplies and taking in what he could at Philadelphia, took the better part of May 1803. By June, he was ready to head back to Washington, meet with Jefferson before beginning the journey west. In all those meetings, the official instructions, or orders really, were hammered out between Jefferson, Lewis, and some members of the president's cabinet. The big issue was to find an all-water route to the Pacific, hopefully by sailing up the Missouri to the Columbia and finally to the sea. Along the way, Jefferson wanted as much knowledge of the land as could be gathered. For his part, Jefferson harbored beliefs that the woolly mammoth was still roaming in the plains and that active volcanoes could potentially be found there. While some wanted Lewis and his party to determine the farmability of the land, that was decidedly secondary to Jefferson. Though he was the yeoman farmer's great champion, Jefferson was very keen on competing with the British in the Pacific Northwest. It was determined that the expedition would have about a dozen members. This small number wouldn't be perceived as a threat, at least they hoped so, by the indigenous people living there. If it did come to a conflict with the Native Americans or other powers, Lewis was ordered to retreat instead of fighting it out. Especially concerning Native Americans, Jefferson wanted to stress to them this was a peaceful mission. One last thing. As part of the company that would make up the mission, it was decided that another officer was needed. You guessed it, this is how William Clark came to be part of the Corps of Discovery. Lewis left Washington, D.C., on July 5th, 1803, on his way to Pittsburgh to pick up the boat he had ordered custom-built for the journey. The hope was that the boat would be finished by July 20th, and the team could get going right away. This was not to be. It turns out the shipbuilder was a bit of a drunk, not very amiable to working in the morning, and sometimes not at all. If you've ever been stranded with a broken-down car with only one service station in the area, you probably have an inkling of the frustration Lewis felt. In his case, there wasn't another shipbuilder for hundreds of miles, so the option of going somewhere else wasn't really there. However, after more than a month's worth of delay, Lewis and his new keelboat were on the way down the Ohio River on August 31st, or the day before he had originally wanted to be in St. Louis. Lewis took off down the Ohio River and made slow but steady progress downriver, stopping by the major ports along the route, Marietta, Cincinnati, and the like. Eventually, he and his party got to the Indiana Territory, settlement of Clarksville, across the river from Louisville. There, they picked up the other commander of the expedition, William Clark, living with his famous brother, George Rogers Clark. Kind of funny, the Clarks living in a town named after them, but easy to remember for them, I suppose. While there, the famous George, a general in the army, swore in the remaining volunteers for the mission. It was official. The Corps of Discovery was on the books. Along with the service members, Clark was also accompanied by a slave named York. The servitude of York also highlights the generational aspect of slavery. Clark's father was attended by York's father. As the expedition traveled west, York experienced more freedom than most slaves ever would. He would be permitted a rifle and was allowed to vote when a corps-wide decision needed to be made. There's more to share about York, but I'll save that for later. When the boats arrived at the mouth of the Ohio, a great realization hit both Lewis and Clark. They needed a lot more manpower. Sometimes moving as slow as a mile per hour, getting vessels upstream was an almost impossible task, and one they would be doing for a considerable amount of time. The journey from the Ohio up the Mississippi to St. Louis was one hell of a wake-up call. Finally, on December 7th, they arrived in St. Louis. They would actually winter on the Illinois side of the river before heading out the following year. As they wintered in the area, they were making preparations and training the new men brought along, now totaling 25 in all. All that was left to do, essentially, was wait until spring. I do wonder, though, if going upstream in the fall was as slow as with going upstream in the fall as slow as a mile an hour, what it would be like with spring thaw and the swell within the Mississippi and Missouri. Turns out they waited quite a while to actually get going. But on May 21st, 1804, the Corps of Discovery turned upstream on the Missouri River, and off they went. It was, as you might imagine, tough sledding, averaging about 5 miles a day. The keelboat, however, was outfitted with a sail, and on more than one occasion they managed to make 20 miles in a day. Part of the slowish pace was the amount of debris that came down the river. Whole trees, felled by winter storms and spring floods, came crashing down on the expedition. Even so, the usual setup was something like this. Clark in command on the keelboat, and the two support boats, called pirogues, I think that's how you say it, under the command of a sergeant or corporal. Lewis was usually on the shore, walking and collecting samples for the scientific aspect of the mission. Lewis spent quite a lot of time alone during the journey, and was in his element while doing so. As they made their way that first summer, Lewis and Clark weren't completely alone in their journey up the Missouri. They encountered traders making their way back to St. Louis, loaded down with pelts and other tradable goods, which, if needed, Lewis would purchase. How did he do such a thing in the middle of nowhere, in a time when cash was pretty scarce? Lewis basically had an open checkbook from Jefferson. When he made a purchase, he'd write a note that the traders could then exchange for cash in St. Louis. Huntsmen and traders weren't the only encounters. Even though Lewis had thought ahead and bought mosquito netting, in the early 19th century, netting is really not the best. It couldn't really be worn also while piloting the boats. And the mosquitoes weren't the only pests that got to the party. Gnats came along in clouds. Flies were abundant, and other critters made themselves welcome on the rivers and at the camps. When the Corps reached the mouth of the Kansas River, it was time for a little break. It was a significant geographical point on the way up the Missouri, so more precise observations were made, along with greater collection and data gathering. All told, they stopped for about 4 days. Unfortunately, young men being young men, someone found his way into the alcohol supply, and, well, you could probably fill in the blanks. In this case, one Private Collins dipped into the sauce while on duty and convinced his comrade, a certain Private Hall, to join him. When their sergeant found them, they were good and drunk. An immediate court-martial was called. For being the instigator, Collins received 100 lashes on his bare back. Hall was given 50. Bit of a brutal consequence for some booze, if you ask me. The Corps of Discovery had journeyed about 400 miles across the present-day state of Missouri to the site, give or take, of modern-day Kansas City. Many miles to go, to say the least, but it's a good point for us to stop as well. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, feel free to drop me a line at ushistorypod@gmail.com. Something new, consulted sources are going to be in the show notes on the website. Also, a special thanks to Chris, and if you're feeling generous, support me on Patreon at patreon.com/ushistorypodcast. Until next time, take care. Thanks for listening to the History of the United States podcast.